right, but the Lakewood Methodist Church on the corner of Michigan and Sycamore was having a Saturday parking lot sale raising money for community service programs like free daycare, 12-step program meetings, and, she didn't know, maybe Meals on Wheels. She was neither a churchgoer nor a baptized Methodist, but she was fairly certain that sauntering through a parking lot full of card tables brimming with yard sale debris was not an act of worship. As a hoot, she almost bought a set of aluminum TV dinner trays, but three of them showed signs of rust. Boxes of costume jewelry revealed no treasures. But then she saw a set of Tupperware ice pop makers. As a kid, she had been in charge of pouring Kool-Aid or orange juice into the molds and inserting the patented plastic handles, which, when the freezer had done the physics, made for inexpensive, icy treats. She could almost feel the hot wind of summer in the foothills, her hands sticky from melting, fruity ice. With no haggling, she got the set for a dollar. On the same table was the typewriter, the color of faded pop art red, not an attraction. What got her eye was the adhesive label glued to the top left corner of its housing, in lowercase letters and underlined by using the shift and six key. The original owner had typed, "These are the meditations of my heart." The words had been typed as many as 30 years ago, when the machine was brand new, just out of the box, perhaps a gift on a girl's 13th birthday. A more recent owner had typed, "Buy me for $5 on a piece of paper, and rolled it into the carriage. The machine was a portable, the body was plastic, the ribbon was two-tone, black over red, and there was a hole in the lid where the name Smith Corona or Brother or Olivetti had once been plugged. There was also a reddish leatherette carrying case with a half-sleeve opening and push-button latch. She punched three of the keys, A, F, P. They all clacked onto the paper and settled back again, so the thing worked, sort of. "Is this typewriter really only $5? She asked of a lady Methodist at a nearby card table. "That?" the woman said. "I think it works, but nobody uses typewriters anymore." That was not the question she had asked, but she didn't care. "I'll take it. Show me the money." And just like that, the Methodists were $5 richer. At her apartment, she prepped a supply of pineapple juice ice pops for later that night. She'd have a couple when the day cooled, when she could have her windows open and watch for the first fireflies of the evening. She pulled the typewriter from its cheap case, set it out on her tiny kitchen table, and rolled in a piece of printer paper from the feed of her laser writer. She tried each of the keys. Many stuck. One of the four rubber feet on the bottom of the body was missing, so the machine rocked a bit. She pounded each of the keys from the top row straight across, shifting to caps as well, trying, with some degree of success, to shake loose the stickiness. Though the ribbon was old, the letters were legible. She tried the spacing of the carriage return, single and double, which worked, although the bell did not. The margin sliders scraped and then jammed in place. The typewriter needed a firm scrubbing and a lube job, which she expected to run, say, $25. But she pondered the greater conundrum, the one that faces all who buy a typewriter in the third millennium. What is its purpose? Addressing envelopes, her mom would enjoy typewritten letters from her wandering daughter. She could send poison pen messages to her ex like, "Hey, knothead, you made a big fucking mistake," with no fear of an email record. She could type out some remark, take a digital photo of it with her phone, then post that onto her blog and Facebook page. She could make to-do lists for the refrigerator door. That made for five hipster retro reasons for her to own a new old typewriter. Chuck in a few heartfelt meditations, and she had six valid uses. She typed the original owner's intent for the machine. The, tab meditate shuts up my heart. The spacebar skipped, which would not do. She grabbed her phone and Googled old typewriter repair. Three listings gave her the choices of a shop 2 hours away, near Ashtabula, a place downtown that did not answer its phone, or, crazily enough, Detroit Avenue Business Machines, which was just a few minutes walk away. She knew the shop. It was next to a tire store. She had strolled past it many times on her way to a great pizzeria and, a few doors down, to the art supply store that was soon to go out of business. She thought the small shop was for computers and printer repair, so after taking a few minutes' walk, was amused to see, upon closer inspection of its front window, an old adding machine, a 30-year-old telephone answering machine, something called a dictaphone, and an ancient typewriter. The bell over the door tinkled when she entered. One side of the shop was nothing but printers, boxes of them, along with toner cartridges for any model. The other side of the shop was like a museum for yesteryear's tools of commerce. There were adding machines with 81 keys and pull handles, single-use 10-key calculators, a stenographer's machine, IBM Selectric typewriters, most in beige housings, and, on wall-mounted shelves, dozens of assorted typewriters gleaming black, red, green, and even baby blue. They all appeared to be in perfect working order. The service counter was in the rear of the shop. Behind it were desks and a workbench where an old fellow was going over papers. "How can I help the young lady?" he asked, with a slight accent, most likely Polish. "I'm hoping you can save my investment," she said. She laid the leatherette case on the counter. She unclasped the case and produced the typewriter. The old man let out a sigh at the sight of it. "I know," she said. "This gem needs work. Half the keys are gummed up, it rocks when I type, and the space bar is kablooey, and no bell." "No bell," he said. "Ah. Can you help a girl out? I have $5 sunk into this thing." The old man looked at her, then back at the machine. He let out another sigh. "Young lady, there is nothing I can do for you." She was confused. From what her eyes took in, this was the place to get a typewriter back in working order. On the workbench behind the old man, she could see disassembled machines and parts of typewriters, for crying out loud. "Because none of those parts back there match my typewriter?" "There are no parts for this," he said, waving his hand over the dull red typewriter and leatherette case. "You'd have to order some. I can wait." "You don't understand." On the edge of the counter was a little case for his official business cards. He took one and handed it to her. "What do you read on this, young lady?" She read the card. "Detroit Avenue Business Machines. Printers. Sales. Service. Repair. Closed Sundays, which is tomorrow," she said. "Office hours, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturdays, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. My watch and your clock both show 12:19. She turned the card over. Nothing on the back. "What am I getting wrong?" "The name of this shop," the old man said. "Read the name of my shop." "Detroit Avenue Business Machines." "Yes," he said. "Business Machines." "Okay," she said. "Yeah. Young lady, I work on machines. But this..." Again, a wave of his hand over her $5 typewriter. "This is a toy." He said the word like he was cussing turd. "Manufactured of plastic to look like a typewriter, but this is not a typewriter." He detached the lid on the top of what he called a toy, the plastic bending until it came off with a snap to reveal the workings inside. "The type bars, the levers, the ribbon spools, plastic. The ribbon reverse, the vibrator." She had no idea there was a vibrator in a manual typewriter. He banged on some of the keys, flipped levers, slid the carriage back and forth, spun the platen, hit the backspace key, all in disgust. A typewriter is a tool. In the right hands, one that can change the world. This is meant to take up space and make noise. Can you at least give it a little oil so I can take a whack at changing the world? She asked. I could clean it, oil it, tighten every screw, make the bell ring, charge you $60 and sprinkle fairy dust upon this typewriter. But I would be taking advantage of you. In a year, the space bar would still be, kablooey. Better you take it home and put a flower in it. He slid the typewriter back into its carrying case, like he was wrapping a dead fish in a newspaper. She felt bad, as though she had disappointed one of her teachers with a lazy effort, handing in a poorly structured essay. If she had still been with the knothead, he'd be standing next to her, agreeing with the old man, saying, I told you the thing was a hunk of junk. $5, gone. Look here. The old man waved his arm at the typewriters that lined the wall-mounted shelves. These are machines. They are made of steel. They are works of engineers. They were built in factories in America, Germany, Switzerland. Do you know why they are up on that shelf right now?
Because they are for sale?
Because they were built to last forever. The old man actually shouted. In him, she heard her father hollering, Who left those bikes on the front lawn? Why am I the only one dressed for church? The father of this house is home and needs a hug.
She realized she was smiling at the old man.
This one, he said, moving to the shelves. He took down a black Remington 7 typewriter, a model called Noiseless. Hand me that tablet there.
She found a pad of blank paper on the counter and gave it to him. He ripped off two pages and rolled them into the gleaming, shining machine.
Listen.
He typed the words Detroit Avenue Business Machines. The letters whispered onto the page one by one.
America was on the move, he said. Work was being done in crowded offices, small apartments, on trains. Remington had sold typewriters for years and years. Someone said, let's make a smaller, quieter machine. Bring down the racket. And they did. Did they use plastic parts? No. They re-engineered the tension, the force of the keystroke. They made a typewriter so quiet, it could be sold as noiseless.
Here, type. He spun the machine to face her. She pecked out, Quiet down. I am typing here. I could hardly hear a thing, she said. I'm impressed. She pointed to a two-tone machine, bone white and blue with a rounded body. How quiet is that one?
Ah, a Royal.
He replaced the black Remington 7 and pulled down a gorgeous little writing machine. A Safari Portable. A decent piece of work. He rolled in two more sheets of paper and let her go at the keys. She thought of safari-themed words to type. Mogambo. Buana Devil. I had a farm in Africa. The machine was louder than the noiseless, and the keys did not fly as effortlessly, but there were features on the Royal that post-dated the engineering of the Remington. The number one with an exclamation mark. A button that said, Magic Column Set. And it was two-tone.
Is this bit of royalty for sale? She asked.
The old man looked at her with a smile and a nod. Yes. But tell me, why?
Why do I want a typewriter? Why do you want this typewriter?
You're trying to talk me out of it?
Young lady, I will sell you any typewriter you want. I will take your money and wave you goodbye. But tell me, why this Royal Safari? Because of the color? The typeface? The white keys?
She had to think about it. Again, she felt like she was in school, about to take a test she could fail, a pop quiz when she hadn't done the reading.
Because of my fickle taste, she said. Because I brought that toy typewriter home and got to thinking, I would like to write on a typewriter, rather than in pen and pencil,
But the dang thing is gummed up, and guess what? My local typewriter shop refuses to touch it. In my mind, I see myself at my little table in my little apartment, picking out notes and letters. I own a laptop, a printer, an iPad, and this too, she held up her iPhone. I use them as much as any modern woman does, but... She stopped. She was thinking now about what it was that had moved her to buy a $5 typewriter, one with an unreliable space bar and no bell, and why she was now in this shop more or less arguing with an old man, when just the day before she'd had no opinion whatsoever about old manual typewriters. She continued, I have loopy penmanship like a little girl, so anything I write looks like a motivational poster in a health clinic. I'm not one who types between sips from a tumbler of booze and drags from a pack of smokes. I just want to set down what few truths I've come to know. She went back to the service counter and grabbed the leatherette carrying case. She yanked the plastic typewriter from inside, carried it over to the shelves, and nearly threw it beside the Royal Safari. She pointed to the sticker on the top. I want my yet-to-be-conceived children to someday read the Meditations of My Heart. I will have personally stamped them into the fibers of page upon page, real stream of consciousness stuff, that I will keep in a shoebox until my kids are old enough to both read and ponder the human condition. She heard herself shouting. They will pass the pages back and forth between them. So that's what Mom was doing, making all that noise with all that typing, and I am sorry, I'm yelling. Ah, he said, why am I yelling? The old man blinked at the young lady. You are seeking permanence. I guess I am! She paused long enough to take a deep breath, letting her lungs empty in a cheek-puffing sigh. So, how much for this Jungle Land typewriter? The shop was quiet for a moment. The old man held a finger to his lips, thinking, wondering what to say. This is not the typewriter for you. He picked up the two-tone Royal and placed it back on the wall-mounted shelf. This was made for a young girl going off to her first year of university, her head filled with nonsense, thinking she would soon find the man of her dreams. It was meant for book reports. He pulled down a compact typewriter with a body the color of green seafoam. Its keys were just a shade lighter. This, he said, again rolling two sheets of paper into the carriage, was made in Switzerland. Along with cuckoo clocks, chocolate, and fine watches, the Swiss once produced the finest typewriters in all the world. In 1959, they made this one. The Hermes 2000, the apex, the state-of-the-art in manual typewriters, never to be bested. To call it the Mercedes-Benz of typewriters is to inflate the quality of Mercedes-Benz. Please, type. She felt intimidated by the green mechanical box in front of her. What in the world could she possibly say on a 60-year-old marvel of Swiss craftsmanship? Where would she drive a vintage Benz? In the mountains above Geneva, the snow falls white and pure, and children eat Cocoa Krispies from bowls with no milk. The typeface is Epoca, he said. Look how straight and even it is, like a ruled line. That's the Swiss. See these holes in the paper guide on either side of the vibrator? So. That's the vibrator. Watch. The old man took a pen from his shirt pocket and put the point into one of the holes. He released the carriage, sliding it back and forth, underlining what she had written. In the mountains above Geneva, the snow falls white and pure. You can use different colored inks for different emphasis. And see this knob here on the back? There was a thimble-sized knob with a softly serrated edge. Tighten it or loosen it to adjust the action for the keys. She did. The keys stiffened considerably under her fingertips, and she had to muscle through cuckoo clocks. When carbon paper was needed to make 3 or 4 copies of a letter, the firm setting would strike all the way to the last page, he chuckled. The Swiss kept a lot of records. Turning the knob the opposite way made the keys feather light. Clocks. Mercedes, Hermes, 2 million. Nearly noiseless as well, she said. Indeed, yes, he said. He showed her how easy it was to set the margins by pressing the levers on each side of the carriage. As for tabs, they were set by pressing tab set. This Hermes was made the year I turned 10 years old. It is indestructible. Like you, she said. The old man smiled at the young lady. Your children will learn to type on it. She liked the idea of that. How much is it? Never mind, the old man said. I will sell it to you on one condition, that you use it. Well, not to be impolite, she said, but duh. Make the machine a part of your life, a part of your day. Do not use it a few times, then need room on the table and close it back into its case to sit on a shelf in the back of the closet. Do that, and you may never write with it again. He had opened a cupboard under the displays of old adding machines, searching through spare carrying cases. He pulled out what looked like a square green suitcase with a flap clasp. Would you own a stereo and never listen to records? Typewriters must be used. Like a boat must sail, an airplane has to fly. What good is a piano you never play? It gathers dust and there is no music in your life. He placed the Hermes 2000 into the green case. Leave the typewriter out on a table where you see it. Keep a stack of paper at the ready. Use 2 sheets to preserve the platen. Order envelopes and your own stationery. I will give you a dust cover free of charge. But take it off when you are at home, so the machine is ready to use. Does that mean we are now discussing the price? I suppose so. How much? Ah, the old man said. These typewriters are priceless. The last one I sold for $300. But for young ladies, 50. How about something for my trade-in? She pointed to the toy typewriter she had brought in. She was haggling. The old man looked at her with something akin to the evil eye. What did you pay for that again? $5. You were taken. He pursed his lips. 45. If my wife ever finds out I made such a deal, she will divorce me. Let's keep it between us, then. One thing about the Hermes 2000. It was a lot heavier than the toy. The green carrying case banged against her legs as she carried it home. She stopped twice, putting the machine down not because she needed to rest, but because her palm had gotten sweaty. In her apartment, she did as she had been instructed, as she had promised. The seafoam green typewriter went on her little kitchen table, a stack of printer paper next to it. She made herself 2 pieces of toast with avocado, and sliced a pear into sections for dinner. She pulled up her iTunes on her phone and hit play, putting the phone into an empty coffee mug for amplification, letting Joni sing her old songs and Adele her new stuff as she nibbled at her meal. She wiped her hands of crumbs and finally, in the blush of ownership of one of the finest typewriters ever to come down from the Alps, she rolled 2 sheets into the carriage and began to type. To do. Stationery. Envelopes and letter paper. Write mom once a week. Groceries. Yogurt / honey / half and half. Juice variety. Nuts variety. Olive oil. Greek. Tomatoes and onions / scallions. Cukes. Cheap record player hi-fi. Methodist church? Yoga mat, waxing, dental appointment, piano lessons. Why not? Okay, she said aloud to herself, alone in her apartment. I'd done me some typing. She pushed herself away from the table, from the seafoam green of the Hermes, She pulled the to-do list from the machine and put it on her refrigerator door under a magnet. She pulled the ice pop mold from the freezer and ran it under warm water in the sink, thawing free one of the pineapple pops. Knowing she would have another, she put the Tupperware into the refrigerator to remain cold until she was ready for seconds. In her living room, she opened the windows to get a bit of breeze. The sun had set, so the first fireflies of the evening would begin to flare in a bit. She sat on the windowsill and enjoyed the cold-shaped pineapple and watched as squirrels ran along the telephone wires, perfect sine waves with their bodies and tails. Sitting there, she had her second ice pop as well, until the fireflies began to float magically above the patches of grass and sidewalk. In the kitchen, she rinsed her hands and returned the Tupperware to the freezer. 6 ice pops would be hers tomorrow. She eyed the typewriter on the table. An idea came into her head. How is it, she thought, that the standard version of a woman, single, after a breakup, has her drinking wine alone in a sad, empty apartment until she passes out on the couch with, she didn't know, Real Housewives on the television? She didn't own a television, and her one remaining vice was homemade ice pops. She had never passed out from wine in her life. She sat back down at the table and rolled 2 more pieces of paper into the Hermes 2000. She set the margins in close, like a newspaper column, and the spacing at 1.5. She typed, "A meditation from my heart," then returned the carriage and started a paragraph. Her nearly noiseless typing echoed softly around her apartment and out her open window until long after midnight. Our Town Today with Hank Fassay, back from back in time. Occasionally the tyrants, did I say tyrants? I meant titans, who publish the Tri-Cities Daily News Herald, pay me for taking my wife on trips that mix business with pleasure. Paid vacations to the likes of Rome, Ohio, Paris, Illinois, and the family compound, hers, on the shores of Lake Nixon. Short trips that I then turn into 1,000 words or so of A1 quality journalism, or so my staff tells me. This past week, I went off on a doozy of a salaried adventure. I went back in time, you see. Not to the age of dinosaurs, nor to witness the fall of the czars, or to talk some sense into the captain of the Titanic. Rather, I time-slipped back into my own past, my hazy self-conscious, transported by a certain simple yet magical machine. Innocence breeds adventure. I had set out to provide you readers with a column on the workings of the weekly swap meet at the old Empire Auto Movie Drive-In in Santa Alameda, a monster of a flea market, now in its 39th year, and chock-a-block with sentimental debris and used hard goods. Old kitchen utensils, old clothes, old books, millions of objets d'art, both nice and rather crummy, piles of used tools and racks of new ones, toys, lamps, odd chairs, and a display of hundreds of brand new sunglasses, now bring in cash where carloads of moviegoers once parked to see, say, Krakatoa east of Java on a distant billboard of a screen. They heard the movie from toaster-sized speakers that hooked onto the car's windows. Movies in mono. Imagine the largest yard attic estate sale in the Western world, combined with the going-out-of-business blowout of every Sears store in the country, and you'll have an idea of the scope of the swap, as the regulars call it. All day, you can wander the rows of stalls, set on the hillocks between speaker posts, nibbling on chili dogs and kettle corn, wanting to buy everything the eye fancies, limited only by the cash in your pocket and the cargo space of your car. Had I wanted to, I could have paid less than $200 for a redwood burl table, a 1960s Amana refrigerator freezer, or the front and back seats yanked out of a Mercury Montego. Luckily, I already have those things at home. I was about to retire to the snack bar for a lime shave ice when I set my eyes on an old typewriter, an Underwood portable of ebony that, I kid you not, gleamed in the sun like a Springsteen hot rod. A quick inspection showed the ribbon was good once you advanced the spool a few inches, and the broken-handled case held a small supply of erasable onion skin paper. Even though a man needs a typewriter these days like he needs a timber axe, I offered the kid running the stall all of $40 for this old typewriter with a broken case, and he said, "Sounds good." Should have offered a 20 or a fiver. Once home, I set the machine out on the kitchen table and gave it the quick bound fox jumped over the lazy dogs test. The D key stuck some, and the A key had a slight drop in it. The numbers all worked, and with some repetitive strikes, the punctuation keys loosened up. I typed, "I bought this typewriter today, and what do you know? The thing works, dot, dot, dot." When the bell at the end of the line sounded out clear and clean, and just like that, I was whooshed into the space-time continuum for a voyage back in time which lasted either a wink of an eye or for each moment of the last 49 years. Ding! First stop was the back room of my dad's old auto parts store, which is now the site of public parking lot number 9 at Webster and Alcorn. He had a big old typewriter in there, though I never saw him use it. On weekends, as a kid, I'd poke out my name on it with my little fingers. When I grew into a teenager, I avoided the store as much as I could, because if I showed my face at the shop, Dad would put me to work doing inventory for the rest of the day. Ding! I'm in the 8th grade. The editor of the Frick Junior High School banner. Go, Bobcats! Watching Mrs. K, the journalism teacher, type out my "Welcome, Scrubs" column on the Ditto Master that would become 350 copies of the school paper, a volume read by at least 40 students. I was busting with pride at seeing my first ever byline in a published newspaper. Ding! I'm in high school now, the old campus of Logan High, on the upper floor of a building that was not earthquake safe, never felt a shudder, in a room that was meant for one subject only, typing, levels 1, 2, and 3. For kids wanting to be professional office secretaries. Nothing but desks and indestructible typewriters overseen by a teacher so disinterested in his, her charges that I don't recall seeing our instructor. Someone put a record on a phonograph and we pecked at whatever letter was called out. One semester of typing one was all I needed before volunteering for the audiovisual crew. Instead of being in a classroom, I roamed the halls of Logan, delivering movie projectors and threading up the films for teachers who didn't know how. So I never learned the many formats of business letters or what the heck a salutation is. I would have made a lousy secretary. Anyhow, I've been typing ever since. Ding! It is 2 a.m. in my dorm room at Wardell Pierce College, and I'm pounding out a paper, due in 8 hours, for a rhetoric class, and yes, there was such a subject. My title was Comparative Criticism in Sports Reporting, Baseball/Track, chosen because I was a sports reporter for the Wardell Pierce Pioneer, and that week I had covered both a ball game and a track meet. My roommate, Don Gamelgard, was trying to sleep, but I was on deadline, and because it was raining, there was no way I was going to tramp all the way across the quad to the student service building. As I recall, I aced rhetoric. Ding! I'm at a so-called desk in the so-called office of the Green Sheet Giveaway, the free shopper's guide that once provided the Tri-Cities with oodles of coupons, advertisements, and, in the back pages, local interest stories where regular folks could see their names in print. I was crafting a piece on a dog show just held at the old Civic Auditorium. My pay was $15. When the most beautiful woman who ever started a conversation with me walked by and said, "You type fast." She was right. And since I was the fast type, I wooed her, wed her, and have been her main squeeze for over 40 years. That same dish of American womanhood brought me back from back in time when she came into the kitchen telling me to move that typewriter and set the table for dinner. The grandchildren were coming over, and it was going to be make-your-own taco night, so a mess was due. The Underwood has powers unexplained, a vehicle for my dreams, so I locked it back into its case and carried it to a shelf in my home office pronto. At night, I think it glows in the dark. Footnote: a check of transcript shows I got a B- in rhetoric at WP. My mistake. The past is important to us. Because his plane was getting a new designer interior installed, J.J. Cox was hitching a ride to New York on Burt Allenberry's Whisper Jet Viewliner. "I thought you were a smart man, Burt," J.J. was yelling at his friend. They'd known each other since they were 20-year-old college kids, drivers for FedEx, full of moxie and spunk, their two heads bursting with ideas. They pooled their paychecks to rent a windowless garage on the outskirts of Salina, Kansas, which became their live-in workshop. After 3.5 years of working 120-hour weeks, they came up with a prototype of the Shuffle Access Digital Valve Relay. They might as well have invented fire. 30 years and $756 billion later, J.J. was just now learning that Burt had paid $6 million a pop to some outfit called Chronometric Adventures for, get this, time travel vacations. No, no, no. Cindy, the fourth and youngest ever Mrs. Allenberry, was clearing the lunch china herself. She was well practiced at the chore, since she had been the flight attendant on the plane just a year ago. She had to work fast, as there were but minutes before landing. Two problems with the Viewliner: speed and vertigo. The flights from Salina to New York City took only 64 minutes, barely enough time to lick your fingers clean of the BBQ ribs. The transparent floor and ultra-wide windows made for a nail-biter of a flight, especially if you were afraid of heights. "I thought they had dosed us with some narcotic," Cindy called out from the plane's galley. "You wake up with a terrible headache, and the room looks all different, then you conk right back out and sleep for hours." J.J. could not believe what he was hearing. "Let's figure out this scam. You go into a room, you fall asleep, and wake up when?" "1939," Bert chirped. "Of course you do," J.J. smirked. "But then you pass out, wake up again in 1939, right there in the city, in a hotel on 8th Avenue." Bert was looking down through the fuselage. Pennsylvania was becoming New Jersey. "Room 1114. And you spend the day sitting in a hotel room?" J.J. wanted to slap his own head as well as some sense into that of his friend and partner. "Everything looks real," Cindy continued as she returned to her seat to buckle up for landing. "You can touch things. You can eat and drink and smell. The men wear sticky hair oil and the women use too much makeup, and everyone smokes, and their teeth crooked and stained. Roasted coffee is in the air." Bert was smiling. "From a factory in New Jersey." "You woke up in 1939, J.J. said, "and smelled the coffee." "Then Cindy took me to the World's Fair," Bert said, "for my birthday. We had VIP passes. It was a surprise." Cindy shot her husband a smile and took his hand in hers. "The big 6-0 only comes once." J.J. had a question. Why not go back in time to see the signing of the Declaration of Independence or Jesus on the cross?
You can only go to 1939, Bert explained. June 8th, 1939.
Chronometric Adventures has a franchise in Cleveland. You can go to 1927 and see Babe Ruth hit a home run, but I'm not a baseball fan.
Babe Ruth in Cleveland. J.J. nearly spit. Jesus on the cross.
He's gone back four times without me, Cindy said. I've had enough of everyone thinking we were father and daughter.
I'm going again tomorrow. Bert smiled at the thought.
J.J. was laughing now. $36 million, Bert. For half that, I'll arrange for you to meet Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and do the naked limbo. You'll just have to trust me on how I make it happen.
My husband would live in 1939, Cindy said, but he can only stay 22 hours.
Why only 22 hours? J.J. asked. Bert told him why.
Wavelength in the time-space continuum is finite. You can ride the echo only so long.
They provide this money made of paper and old-fashioned coins, Cindy said. I bought a tiny gold-plated space needle and globe.
The Trilon and Perisphere, Bert corrected her.
Right, yeah. But when we woke up, it had turned into dried-out putty.
That's the molecular singularity.
Bert was not buckling his seatbelt for landing. He owned the plane. Screw the FAA.
Why not go back and change history, J.J. wanted to know. Why didn't you kill Hitler?
Hitler wasn't at the World's Fair that day. The whisper jet began to slow, the ground rising up to meet them. The articulating engines were tilting minutely, soon to allow a vertical landing on the roof of 909 Fifth Avenue.
Besides, it wouldn't matter.
Why the hell not?
Singular dimensional tangents, Bert said, looking down at Central Park, which hadn't really changed all that much since 1939.
There's an infinite number of tangents, but we all exist in just one. J.J. glanced at Cindy. She shrugged her shoulders. What could she do with the old guy?
He liked seeing what the future was going to look like.
But we're living in the future. You'd think that would spoil everything, she said. 12 minutes later, J.J. was zipping along the hover line in his floater, headed to his private island in the Sound. Bert and Cindy had taken their private elevator from the landing pad on the roof and were settling into their apartment on floors 97 to 102. Cindy immediately changed into a new outfit from one of her closets. They were going to Kick Adler Johnson's 25th birthday party and a private hologram performance of the Rolling Stones. Bert could not stand Kick Adler Johnson, though he respected her husband Nick, who had made a fortune buying up air and water rights around the world. Besides, the actual Stones had played the company Christmas party in 2019, when he was married to Audrey, wife number three. He wanted to stay home, but Cindy wouldn't allow that. Bert wished he could go through time right then, forward to the morning, then back to 1939, to the fair that was filled with so many promises of the world as it could have been. On that first birthday visit, Cindy felt ridiculous in the old-style clothes. Bert, though, was in heaven, in a double-breasted suit made to measure by the tailors of Chronometric Adventures. He marveled at every little detail, every second of the 22 hours they spent in 1939. How small New York City seemed. The buildings were not tall at all, so the sky was much more open, the sidewalks had space for everyone, and the automobiles and taxis were huge and so roomy. The cab driver wore a tie and complained of the traffic out to Flushing Meadows. But if that were a traffic jam, Bert would take it. The World's Fair featured the tall Trilon and the huge orb called the Perisphere, both one-of-a-kind architectural marvels that were bleach white and brilliant against the open blue sky. The avenues of patriots and pioneers were meant to be taken seriously, and get this, courts were dedicated to railroads and ships, celebrating technologies that required engines the size of his whisper jet. There was a giant Underwood typewriter, an aquacade show, and Electro, the mechanical man. He walked and counted numbers on his steel fingers. Chronometric Adventures supplied a pair of VIP passes, so Bert and Cindy never had to wait in line. The fairgrounds were kept spotless. A light breeze wiggled the flags and pennants. The hot dogs cost 5 cents. Fairgoers were dressed to the nines, and some women even wore gloves. Hats were on most men's heads. Bert wanted to see all of the world of tomorrow, but Cindy was uncomfortable in her ugly shoes and wouldn't eat hot dogs. They left around 3 p.m, bound for drinks and dinner at the Hotel Astor in Times Square. Cindy was tipsy, tired, and sick of all the cigarette smoke by the time the two of them were back in room 1114 for progression, the trip forward in time. 2 weeks later, Cindy loaded the Whisper Jet with her pack of girlfriends and flew to a spa in Morocco, allowing Bert another 22 hours of 1939. He ordered morning coffee for just himself from Percy, the room service waiter. He had breakfast alone in the coffee shop in the Hotel Astor, the gorgeous place smack on Times Square. He had the same cabbie with a tie. Alone, he covered areas of the fair he had missed, like the town of tomorrow and the electrified farm. He had lunch in the Heinz Dome, surveyed the temple of religion, and celebrated the workers' paradise that was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. He listened to the conversations around him, studied the enthusiasms of the fairgoers, noting the lack of foul language and the bright colors of the clothing, not a black-on-black outfit to be seen. Fair employees seemed proud to work in their various uniforms, and it was true. A lot of people smoked. It was on that second visit, without Cindy, when he spotted a petite, lovely woman in a green dress. She was sitting on a bench by the Lagoon of Nations, overseen by the massive sculptures of the Four Freedoms. She showed a modest amount of leg over brown shoes with straps. She carried a small purse and wore a hat with a white bud of a flower on it, more of a cap, really. She was engaged in an animated conversation with a young girl dressed more for Sunday school than a day at the fair. The two of them were laughing, talking with their hands, whispering secrets to each other like they were the best of pals on the best of days in the best of places. They were the spirit of the fair in feminine form. Bert couldn't take his eyes off them, watching as they left the bench, heading arm in arm toward the Eastman Kodak building. He thought to follow them to see more of the fair through their eyes, but his watch showed nearly 5 p.m., meaning there were little more than 2 of his 22 hours remaining. Reluctantly, he turned for the taxi stand that stood outside the north entrance of the Corona Gate. Another tie-clad taxi driver drove him back to Manhattan. "Ain't the World Fair something?" the cabbie said. "It is," Bert smiled. "You see the Futurama? The trip to 1960? "I did not." Bert, born in 1966, chuckled to himself. "Oh, you gotta see the Futurama," the cabbie said. "It's in a GM building. It's a long line, but worth it." Bert wondered if the lovely woman in the green dress had seen the Futurama, and if so, what she thought of 1960. Although the human body takes a terrific beating by traveling back and forth in time, the Chronometric Adventures medical team gave Bert the go-ahead for a third trip. The World's Fair was too vast to see on just 2 visits, he explained to Cindy, which was true. What he didn't tell her was that, on his return to Flushing Meadows in 1939, he'd spend the day looking for the lady in the green dress. She was not in any of the buildings dedicated to the great humanitarian works of U.S. Steel, Westinghouse, or General Electric. She was not somewhere in the Plaza of Light, the Avenue of Labor, the Court of Peace, or Continental Avenue. She was nowhere Bert had searched. So, a few minutes before 5 p.m., he headed to the Lagoon of Nations, and sure enough, the woman in the green dress was there, her little friend in tow, on that bench under one of the four freedoms. He sat on a bench close enough to hear them compare notes on the marvels of the fair, their local accents turning New York into New York. They simply could not decide what to do next before the evening came and the fountains of light would put on a show of technical, colorful wonder. Bert was trying to summon the courage to speak to them when they rose up and hurried off to the Eastman Kodak, arm in arm, chatting and giggling. He watched them as they walked away, admiring the feminine carriage of the woman in the green dress, her hair bobbing against the back of her neck. He thought about following them, but the time was getting late, and he had to return to room 1114. For weeks, for every other minute, Bert thought of the woman in the green dress, of the way she talked with her hands and of her bobbing hair. He wanted to learn her name, to know her, if only for an extra hour or so of 1939. When Cindy announced she was joining Kick Adler Johnson on a horseback ride through Cuba, he booked another exam with a Chronometric Adventures medical team. He was on the bench by the Lagoon of Nations at 4:45. And yes, right on the tick of the singularity clockwork, the woman in the green dress and her young friend sat down and began their conversation. Bert guessed she was probably in her mid-30s, though the fashions of the times made everyone look older by today's judgments. She was heavier than Cindy, than most modern-day women, as the 1939 diet was not very calorie-conscious, and exercise then was the stuff of athletes and laborers. The woman had an actual figure. The curves did her service. He'd planned on what to say in this first conversation with a woman he had wanted to meet for over 8 decades. "Excuse me," Bert said. "Do you ladies know if the Futurama is running today?" "It is, but the line is very long," said the woman in the green dress. "We spent all afternoon in the amusements area. What a time we had. Have you rode the parachute, mister?" The girl could not have been more delightfully enthusiastic. "I haven't," Bert confessed. "Should I?" "It's not for the weak-hearted," the woman said. "You go up and up and up," the girl said, waving her hands. "You think you're going to come floating down, slow and soft, but you don't. You land ka-joink." "It's true," the woman and the girl traded laughs. "Have you seen the Futurama?" Bert asked. "We didn't want to wait through that long line," the woman said. "Well," Bert said, reaching into the pocket of his double-breasted suit, "I have a couple of special passes I'm not going to use." Bert handed over the same two heavy cards Chronometric Adventures had supplied for his first trip with Cindy, the tickets embossed with a Trilon and Perisphere, and the letters VIP. "If you show these to the attendants at the bottom of the ramp, I mean the helicline, they take you in via secret passage." "Oh, that's so nice of you," the woman said. "But we are definitely not VIPs." "Believe me, neither am I," Bert said. "I had to get back to the city. Please, use them." "Can we, Aunt Carmen?" the girl asked, begged, actually. Carmen. Carmen was the name of the woman in the green dress. Carmen. The name fit her perfectly. "I feel like a sneaky Pete," Carmen said, pausing. "But let's. Thank you so much." "Yes, thanks," her niece said. "My name is Virginia, and this is my Aunt Carmen. Who are you?"
"Bert Allenberry."
"Well, thank you, Mr. Allenberry," Virginia said. "We owe our future to you."
Arm in arm, the women headed down Constitution Mall toward the GM building, home of the Futurama. Bert watched them go, feeling grand, happy he had returned to 1939. For months, he daydreamed of the lovely Carmen, the sneaky Pete. Though his body was in the office in Salina, the board meeting in Tokyo, on the boat off Mykonos, his mind was in Flushing Meadows, on a bench under the Four Freedoms, on a day in early June of 1939.
When a shareholders' meeting demanded his presence in New York, he made time for another $6 million visit to room 1114. The events played out as before. He offered Carmen and Virginia the VIP passes, and off they went, owing their future to him. Bert, though, wanted just a bit more time with Carmen. Not long, just another half hour or so. So he stationed himself at the exit of Futurama. He waved to them as they came out. "How was it?" he called to them. "Mr. Allenberry," Carmen said. "I thought you had to leave." "Oh, I'm the boss, so I decided to change the rules." "You're the boss?" Virginia asked. "A what?" "Of all the people I get to boss around." "Well, since you are now in the presence of a couple of VIPs," Carmen said with a laugh, "may I treat you to some pie? I happen to love pie."
"Let's go to Borden's," Virginia piped. "We can see Elsie the cow."
The three of them sat together with 10 cents a slice pie, cut into perfectly measured wedges. Carmen and Bert had nickel-a-cup coffees. Virginia had a glass of milk and talked about what marvels the year 1960 would bring, according to Futurama's predictions.
"I hope I don't still live in the Bronx in 1960, she said.
Virginia's family lived in an apartment on the Parkway, with her mother, Carmen's sister, and father, who was a butcher. She was in the fifth grade, belonged to the radio club, and wanted to be a teacher when she grew up, if she could afford college. Carmen shared a fourth-floor walk-up on East 38th Street with two roommates who worked as secretaries at an insurance company. She was the bookkeeper in a handbag factory downtown. All of them agreed that the World's Fair of 1939 was even better in real life than in the newsreels.
"Is your wife in New York, Mr. Allenberry?"
Bert wondered how Carmen knew he was married, then realized he was wearing the wedding ring provided by Chronometric Adventures. He'd put it on by habit.
No, he said. "Cindy is with friends in Cuba."
"That's where Mom and Dad went on their honeymoon," Virginia said. "I came along not long after."
"Virginia!"
Carmen could not believe her niece. "Be proper."
"It's true," Virginia said.
She had eaten all her pie filling, saving the crust for last.
"Are you married, Carmen?"
Bert asked.
"I'm sorry, I don't even know your last name."
"Perry," she said. "Carmen Perry, so rude of me." "And no, I'm not married." Bert knew that already, as no ring rode her left hand.
"Mama says if you don't find a man soon, there'll be none left for you," Virginia said. "You're almost 27.
"You hush," Carmen hissed,
reaching over with her fork to stab the best piece of crust, then popping it into her mouth.
"You dirty rat!"
Virginia laughed. Dabbing her lips with a napkin, Carmen smiled at Bert. "It's true, I'm the last hen in the barnyard." Carmen was only 26? Bert could have sworn she was older. After the pie, they looked at Elsie the cow, then toured the Academy of Sports. After watching films of trick water skiers, Bert looked at his vintage wristwatch. It was almost 6 p.m. "I really do have to leave now."
"Oh, it's a shame you can't stay to see the fountains in the light show," Carmen said. "It's so lovely, they say."
"And there's fireworks every single night," Virginia piped up. "It's like it's the 4th of July all summer long."
"Virginia and I have a spot picked out to watch." Carmen's eyes were on Bert. "You sure you can't stay?"
"I wish I could."
Bert truly wished he could. Carmen was as lovely a woman as he had ever seen. Her lips were not too thin, her smile was firm and mischievous, and her eyes were hazel, emerald green and tinted brown.
"Thank you for a great time," Virginia said. "We were VIPs."
"Yes, thank you, Mr. Allenberry." Carmen offered her hand. "You've been very kind and a lot of fun." Bert took Carmen's hand, her left hand, the hand with no wedding ring. "I've had a grand day." In the cab on the drive back into Manhattan, Bert could almost smell Carmen's perfume, vanilla-scented lilac. After one too many encores by the holographic Rolling Stones, Kick Adler Johnson's birthday party had gone until 4 a.m. Cindy was now asleep in bed, with the door closed and the blackout shades tightened down. Bert, though, was up at 8, showered and dressed, with a coffee in his hand. He had a breakfast of mixed